Do please grab a seat, and if you could turn up again in your Bibles, but this time page 553, starting a new series in the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, 553. I'm going to read chapter 1, verses 1 to 11. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes. But the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Do please keep Bibles open, and inside your sheet there's some headings which will be a help, hopefully, to you. When you're a teenager, you think you can do anything, and you do. Your 20s are a blur. Your 30s, you raise your family, you make a little money, and you think to yourself, what happened to my 20s? Your 40s, you grow a little pot belly. You grow another chin. The music starts to get too loud. One of your old girlfriends from school becomes a grandmother. 50s, you have a minor surgery. You call it a procedure, but it's a surgery. 60s, you have a major surgery. The music is still loud, but it doesn't matter because you can't hear it anyway. 70s, you and the wife retire, start eating dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Lunch around 10, breakfast the night before. And you spend most of your time wandering around shopping malls looking for the ultimate soft yogurt and muttering, how come the kids don't call? The 80s, you've had a major stroke, and you end up babbling to some Jamaican nurse whom your wife can't stand but whom you call mummy. Any questions? Well, you might recognize that summary of what life is all about. It's from the film City Slickers, and it's given by quite a cynical character in that film, played by Billy Crystal. And if you've seen the film, what's semi-amusing about the scene is that he's giving this kind of pep talk to a class of eight-year-old kids, and they begin his talk all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and excited, and by the end of it, you just look across, and they've all got their heads in their hands, just despairing about the absolute futility of the decades laid out ahead of them. Now, I know that some people get pretty twitchy and upset about thinking about the big questions in life. And the fear is that if we look too hard into the big questions, we will end up as cynical and as demotivated as that Billy Crystal character. And I think that's why so many people today just seem to live life by distraction, keeping so busy that we never have to think about meaning or death or God or anything, actually, which might unsettle us until so often it's too late. And this book we're starting today, and I'm looking forward to getting stuck into, Ecclesiastes, is not afraid of asking the big questions of life. This book is going to be uncomfortable reading. And the reason it's uncomfortable is because it dismisses the easy and the glib answers. And instead, this book is going to take us on an uncomfortable journey, but with the purpose of leading us onto firmer ground and helping us to live wisely in this world. So let's get into it. I'm going to read again verse 1. It begins with these words, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, historically, most people have assumed this is a reference to King Solomon, David's literal son. And he certainly seems a good candidate for this preacher. And this is his message, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I think this is possibly the most famous line in the book. It tops and tails the whole book. You get it here and then at the end of the preacher's word in chapter 12, verse 8. And this word vanity crops up around 30 times in total in the book. It's the big theme we're going to hit again and again. And that word translated vanity, hebel, in the Hebrew, if you look through different translations, you'll discover that it's obviously difficult to translate. Some translations go for meaningless, which I think is almost certainly mistaken. The preacher definitely doesn't think life is meaningless. In fact, he's going to spend the book persuading us that some things are better than other things. And because there is a God who is creator and judge, life really does have a purpose. Literally, this word hebel means mist or vapor. And you'll see on the top of the sheets, I've entitled this series, Living in the Mist or Living in the Fog. Mistiness, mistiness, says the preacher. Everything is mistiness. That's how we could translate verse 2. And we'll see as we go through that the writer has in mind two particular ways in which he thinks life is foggy, or like mist, like Andrew's spray mist. And the first is that it's hard to grasp. That is, it's hard also to understand, just like mist slips through your fingers. And the second way that life is like fog or mist is that things just don't last, just like morning mists are gone by the time lunchtime comes. So much in life is fleeting and gone. And so the big message of this book is that the preacher wants us to come to terms with the fact that life is not neat, and often things are fleeting and temporary. And he wants us to learn to be humble and to live wisely in the light of that fact. So let's get on to his big question there in verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What's the point of it all? You can hear this is a bit like Billy Crystal's reflections in that film. Does anything we do actually achieve anything ultimately? And I've summarized the preacher's answer in these verses on those sheets. And the first part of his answer is there, number one, our toil cannot produce ultimate gain. This sheet is a little bit different from the one I produced, and I think there's two going around. Could you hold up a hand if your heading says, our toil cannot produce ultimate gain? No. Okay, that's a bit of a mix-up. Could you, if you've got a pen, go for that one. Cross that one out and write, our toil cannot produce ultimate gain. As you'll see, it's evolved through the week. And you'll see how. Now, the British astronaut, Piers Sellers, he died just before Christmas. And if you read his obituaries, they quoted what he described as being given a God's eye view of the planet. And he said this, as an astronaut, I spacewalked 220 miles above the Earth. Floating alongside the International Space Station, I watched hurricanes cartwheel across the oceans, the Amazon snake its way to the sea through a brilliant green carpet of forest, and gigantic nighttime thunderstorms flash and flare for hundreds of miles along the equator. From this God's eye view, I saw how fragile and infinitely precious the Earth is. Now, a little bit like Piers Sellers on his spacewalk, our writer is trying to give us a God's eye view of the Earth. Only instead of the perspective gained from just a few hours of spacewalks, our writer wants us to give a time-lapse picture of thousands of years of human history. And he says, come up with me and watch the God's eye view, the time-lapse picture of all human existence on this planet. And let me show you what you will see. Have a look at verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. And from this vantage point, he says, the generations, a little bit like the seasons, a little bit like the elements, they come and they go. And ultimately, there's no real progress from it. Now, I'm guessing that each one of us here will have had a busy month in various respects, trying to complete assignments or projects or hit deadlines or juggle responsibilities at home, always trying to tick off certain objectives, you know, hit the things on our to-do list and so on. And the writer says, come again with me, hold that in your head, and come again with me on the spacewalk. Watch with me the whole time lapse of human history, the days and the seasons, the births and the deaths, the kingdoms and the empires coming and going. And then think about those projects you've had on this month and ask this question, verse 3. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? As we came through the foot tunnel that comes up in Greenwich, Cutty Sark, over Christmas, we saw, and you may have seen them as well, some artists with hammers and chisels making absolutely fantastic ice sculptures. And there were some like life-sized animals. There's one 8-foot replica of Buckingham Palace and so on. But of course, when we came back a couple of days later, it was quite warm and they'd all just melted away, gone. In fact, my children's sandcastles that we built over the summer, even after we'd spent hours making sure they were the best sandcastles on the beach, in my opinion. But of course, as soon as the tide came, there was nothing to be shown for them. And our writer wants us to face this uncomfortable realization, as I haven't put on the sheets, our toil cannot produce ultimate gain. But the writer, the preacher, he knows how much we hate this news, this realization. We find making no ultimate gain deeply frustrating. And one way we deal with it is that we construct a story, an illusion of progress. We spend a lot of time talking about and going to see whatever is newest. Because, of course, if something's new, then that reassures us that progress is being made. And our writer wants to say, abandon that delusion. And this is my summary of points of verses 8 to 11. Don't be deceived by apparent progress. Don't be deceived by apparent progress. Let me read verse 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. And here comes his challenge, verse 10. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? Nah, it has been already in the ages before us. Now, immediately when we read that, we want to say, but hang on, what about the iPhone 7? Or what about Rocky 7? Rocky 8 out later this year? And I think our writer would say, well, yes, you have got an iPhone 7. Well, I haven't, but some people have. Is it really so different from the iPhone 6, he'd say? And even in the 80s, didn't you have one of those big bricks that did something similar? And was any of it really any different from Alexander Graham Bell's invention at the end of the 19th century? And really, hasn't this idea of sending messages to people a long way off actually been going for millennia? Yes, I can see there are some changes, but is anything really new, radically new? And he says, come with me up to the space station again and watch with me that time-lapse film. You can bring your iPhone 7 and you will see it is not as big a deal as you think it is. Rocky 7, on the other hand. No. And then he goes onto the front foot and he says that the reason we're so quick to fall for this progress illusion, he says, is because we've got such short memories. Look at verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. That's why we fall for the delusion. Now, I said Ecclesiastes initially can be very uncomfortable reading. At first, it sounds like this preacher is a first millennium BC Billy Crystal type character. But actually, we're going to see that in the bigger argument of the book, the preacher's doing this demolition job because he wants to construct something beautiful and positive in its place. And in particular, he wants us to grasp two crucial things about gain. Firstly, probably in the opposite order you've got, we're to entrust gain to God. And second, that life's about gift, not gain. So first, we're to entrust gain to God. Now, if all we had was verses 1 to 11, we might think that the writer here had an Eastern cyclical view of history. There's no beginning, no direction, no end. Life just cycles around and around indefinitely. As we read on, we will see that is certainly not what the preacher believes at all. In fact, as you'd expect from a son of David, he's a faithful Israelite believer. He believes history has a beginning. He calls God creator, chapter 12, verse 1, and an end, when God will bring everything into judgment and put everything right. I'm actually not going to expand much more on this point now, because we're going to look more at it next week. But for now, I really want us to focus on this second message that I think the preacher wants us to grasp, that life's about gifts more than it's about gain. And one of the big messages of this book is not simply to redirect where we might find gain, although it will do that, but rather it challenges our whole outlook, and it says, asking where is the gain in all this is, practically speaking, not the most helpful question for us to be obsessing about. And learning this from Ecclesiastes, personally, over the last couple of years, has actually been a big paradigm shift for me, and I hope it will be helpful for you as well, especially if it's not something you've thought a lot about before. One of the fascinating things about this passage is that in critiquing always grasping for gain, the preacher doesn't do, for example, what Jesus does in the parable of the barns. Do you remember that parable in the New Testament? Jesus describes a guy who, on the surface of it, he seems like a clever, a wise planner. He doesn't fritter away his wealth. He saves it and he prepares for a rainy day. But Jesus makes the point, what good is that in the light of death? And ultimately, God will say to that person who spent their whole life not thinking about God, not thinking about eternity, God will say to that person, you fool. So in that parable, at least, Jesus is encouraging us, a bit like that first application, entrust gain to God. He's saying, invest now in the light of the final judgment. And obviously, that's true and important. But this preacher here in Ecclesiastes is making a rather different argument, and he's got a different angle. So here he takes a pre-fall creational illustration before death and degradation comes onto the scene of history. And he shows us, this is in verses 5 to 7, how these things which God created good in Genesis 1, remember, God made the path of the sun, which governs day and night in Genesis 1, and everything, the course of the winds, the water cycle. All these beautiful and glorious parts of creation never ask the question, where is the gain? In fact, the sun is content to, in our passage, verse 5, hasten back to the place where it rises and do it all again. And the sun seems eager, even happy about it. It's good. And it's only fallen humanity that struggles so much with this repetition of the days and weeks and years in verse 8. And there's a hint even here that fallen human beings may be obsessing about the wrong question. And by the time we get to the end of chapter 2, verses 24 to 26, we find the beginnings of a new paradigm, a different paradigm. And this is the paradigm which gets repeated throughout the book at the end of chapter 5 and at the end of chapter 8, that life is not principally about gain anyway. It's actually about grace. Life is about receiving gifts from our loving Creator. So flip over the page, chapter 2, 24. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? What if life wasn't a computer game about achieving the most gain before the time runs out? What if life rather was an arena, a theatre in which we as creatures get to receive good gifts from our Creator so that we can know him and enjoy him better through his gifts? Since I started to discover this perspective from Ecclesiastes over the last couple of years, I've tried to think slightly differently about my day. Ordinarily, at the end of the day, JC will ask me something like, how was your day? And previously, I would run through in my head how many of my goals I'd achieved. You know, what gain I felt had been accomplished. And actually, how my day had gone was basically an assessment of how much gain I had accomplished. Perhaps you do something similar. But I think the preacher is saying a more helpful way to think of our days is to run through, well, what gifts have I received today? Yesterday has had some challenges and some frustrations, but actually there are still plenty of things that I've received from the Lord's hand and I can be thankful for. And God has shown his kindness in all kinds of ways to me today, even amidst lots of frustrations. One of the things we do with the children at tea time is something called highs and lows, and they each of them have to say what was the top thing and the worst thing about their day. And then we try later on in the evening to convert whatever the highs were into points of thanksgiving to God. I'm actually slightly nervous about sharing this sort of thing because it gives the impression that we live this blissful, perfect family life, and we really don't. It's mainly chaos, but this is at least an aspiration for us, if not yet a reality lots of the time. But to be asking simply, how did the spelling test go? What was gained today? Isn't the approach we need. We need to be thinking, well, what today have we received from the Lord? What can we thank our Father for today? I'm not always a fan of Richard Curtis films, but I really like the one, I think it was 2013, About Time. And it's about a father and a son who can time travel back to earlier points in their own lives. And there's one point where the father, Bill Nighy, gives his son, Donald Gleason, this advice. It's about time travel. Live each day twice. The first time, live it as normal with all the tensions and worries. But the second time, live it almost exactly the same. But this time, free to notice and enjoy how sweet the world can be. And then in the film, we watch this same scene twice of this son rushing to court to present his case. He's a lawyer. But the second time he does the same thing, but he notices the birds are singing and he notices just how majestic the buildings are that he's in, that he'd missed the first time. And of course, before long, this son has learnt the trick of only needing to live each day once because he's learnt this skill of appreciating everything as if he were living it through for the second time. And I think the preacher here would approve of that message. Learn to live each day, not obsessed always with where's the gain, where's the gain, what have I achieved, what have I achieved. But learning to live each day, noticing, and crucially, which is missing from the film, crucially thanking God for every gift which he gives us. Now I'm guessing, and kind of hoping, that this is raising some questions for us if we're Bible readers. You might be wondering how this fits with the rest of the Bible's teaching, for example. Specifically, you might be thinking, well, what if any of this changes when we step into the New Testament? And I'm going to pick up both of those questions before we close. So first, how does all this fit in with the rest of the Bible's teaching? Well, actually, one reason on the sheets I put life's about gifts more than gain, rather than life's about gifts not gain, and the reason we had that point in trust gain to God is there is a right place for pursuing gain and profit and achievement. But the point here is that it's not everything. When God gave humanity a work to do, which he did when he told Adam to cultivate the Garden of Eden, And we had that reading from Genesis 2. That wasn't an end in itself. It's not as if Adam was just brought into the world as a unit of productivity, left in the factory to get on with the task, and then God would come back at the end, check it was all done satisfactorily. That was it. Now, Adam's work, and he is given a work to do, but it's set in the bigger context of Adam's relationship with his creator. So work is not the only thing in Adam's life. He's got a beautiful, fruitful garden to enjoy. He's got a wife. He's got a loving creator to walk with in the cool of the day and so on. But since God himself is a worker, he's introduced in Genesis 1 as one who accomplishes tasks and then enjoys the fruit of them. He's a worker. Naturally, Adam learns to relate to God by joining God in his work. It's a little bit like the toddler who helps his daddy with the DIY or helps his daddy in the kitchen. It's not strictly because the father needs the help, which I can assure you of. But the DIY or the cooking is the situation in which the toddler gets to hang out with and get to know his or her father, and in which the toddler actually learns to be more like their dad. So work is given in the much bigger context of relationship. And that's why in a fallen world, if you erase the relationship with our Creator, then all you've got left is this work to do. You've either got to buy into a delusion that it's, you know, achieving something lasting, or you're faced with this depressing fact that it all feels pointless. So going back to the sandcastle analogy, do you remember? Well, imagine now a father, I can imagine this well, he takes his daughter out to build sandcastles on the beach, which in my opinion would be an excellent way to spend a day, if not a fortnight. Now, if the child approaches that task entirely from a gain mentality and totally ignores the context of relationship and joy and receiving and learning from and growing like the parent, then I guess two things are likely to happen. First, the child is very likely to get stressed. Imagine it. If the only thing that matters that day is gain, 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 then if they're not hitting their targets, if the sandcastle isn't quite the way they wanted it, then that is a disaster. That is a wasted day. And second, when later the inevitable does happen and the tide washes their project away, that child is going to be devastated. And either they'll give up on building sandcastles altogether, or they will obsess about how next time they're going to make sure their work is slightly more tide resistant, and that's going to be their project. But of course, if the child understands that the task is in the context of something much, much more important, their relationship with their father, then of course they're still going to want to make the best sandcastle they've ever made. Of course they will. They want to grow, they want to learn, they want to use their creativity to the limit. But then if it doesn't work out quite right, or of course when they see the tide flatten it later on, of course that's going to be a bit disappointing, but it will not be devastating. After all, life is about gifts more than gain. They still got to spend the day with their father. And best of all, he was pleased with what they made. And that's what counts. So that's looking at it in the context of the whole Bible, Genesis 2 in particular. What about that second question? What, if anything, of this changes when we get to the New Testament? Have a look again at verse 10. Do you remember that question? Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? Do you remember the expectation was no? But of course, actually, when we get to the New Testament, the answer to that question changes and it becomes yes. Yes, at last there is something new. There is a man who at last is raised from the dead, never to die again. There is a human being at last who didn't come and go like all those generations described in verse 4. There's someone who can live forever. And for those who are joined to the Lord Jesus, we also are new. New creations is what the New Testament calls us, already caught up in that future eternal world. And so whilst there are changes when we get to the New Testament, the newness idea, I think this point, life is about gift not gain, stays exactly the same. In fact, the labor that we do, even labor in the Lord, you know, the New Testament's language for cooperating with God's great building project of building up a people for himself, even that labor in the Lord is still not ultimate. If you think about it, God does not need our efforts. Any way that we get to partner with him in the work of the gospel is a little bit like those toddlers helping with the DIY or in the kitchen. It is all for our benefit, not for his. We're not units of productivity. We are children who get to join in with our Father's project. And the New Testament still calls us to enjoy with thankfulness God's ordinary gifts to us each day, acknowledging the God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. If we are believers today, some of us will probably remember that moment when we first discovered that truth, that salvation is all of grace. It's sheer gift. And we've been concentrating on that in our studies in Romans. Well, how wonderful it is to discover that God, our Creator, has the same way of operating as God, our Savior, does. And that even our day-to-day lives of working and eating and sleeping are first and foremost an arena for grace, for receiving gifts from God, where we learn to receive his gifts in thankful dependence on him. Let's have a moment's quiet to look again at the verses, and then we'll have our prayers led for us.